I was very moved once when a friend of mine, whose wife was pregnant with their second child, he came to me, they came to me, the couple, at her urging, and he said, "I love my daughter, my firstborn, so much," he said, "I can't imagine how I could love anyone else as much." And he was actually worried because he was going to have a second child and he just didn't know how he would respond. It was a very touching concern. And all I could say was, "It'll be okay, you'll see." And because there's this thought in our minds that we're dealing with some kind of limited quantity, and that we're also dealing within ourselves with a limited capacity. And so, just as you're saying, you think, well, I'm going to have to now take care of a baby. How do I take care of everything else? As if somehow it's going to run out. Now, there is true that we have sometimes a limited amount of energy and a limited number of hours in the day. So those are factors. But we don't really have any limitation in our capacity. So there's a lot here that we can sort of talk about and work with. So let me just think for a moment. Were you going to speak? No. Okay, I thought I heard you start to speak. Sometimes because we're a very westernized culture, although no one in this room was born in America, but you're all living here and we're all very westernized. Oh, this one will be born in America. But it isn't yet. Okay. Will she or he be an American citizen then? Oh, automatically. So you'll be green cards and they'll be citizens? Yeah. I guess that's how it works here. Okay.
That's another thing we deal with sometimes because we were born and brought up in India, so we think we are completely Indian, but we can't transfer that. Something that was so automatic, that we just took for granted.
Yeah.
We have to relate differently now.
Yeah, you don't know.
Surroundings will be different.
Yeah, exactly. You can't duplicate an Indian upbringing in Silicon Valley. All that's very interesting. As I was starting to say, sometimes in our Western intellectuality, our way of understanding the world, which we're all trained in, regardless of our culture, culture gives us a certain bias, but just the way the world is right now, we tend to think about things first from our mind, and we tend to think our ideas about things and the way we conceptualize them are the primary truth. In the biggest picture of spiritual understanding, it's the feeling nature that actually defines us, in the sense that even when all thoughts are gone, we still have awareness, and that awareness has a feeling nature to it. That's why the definition of the source of creation, the best Sanskrit word for the English word God, is Sat Chit Ananda, which means ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy. There's no thought, there's no concept there, that's just the feeling that you have. That when everything else goes away, what's left is feeling, and the more attuned we are to our real origin point, the more that the feeling that we have is joy. John and I were talking before the rest of you arrived about the fact that his father, who lives in Kenya, recently died. John was just beginning to tell me about his father's last year of life when he was in the hospital and, a very powerful man had become quite debilitated. My own father died 6, 7, maybe even 10 years ago, and I can't keep track of time that well. And the last few years of his life, his brain became affected. I don't know if he had full-blown Alzheimer's, but he definitely had many symptoms of age-related dementia. He lost the ability to have very coherent speech. But he always recognized me, and he was sort of always himself. And it was fascinating for me to watch this. I was very fond of my father. He was a very good man, very intelligent man, a mathematician, sort of oriented that way. But he tended to be a bit anxious about things. He had a Virgo mind, and he was always taking things apart and thinking about something to worry about. And he would sometimes drive me quite crazy with his, nitpicking about small things. Well, when he began to lose his mental acuity, and especially after my mother died a couple of years before him, he forgot what he was worried about. And he no longer had the ability to sort of be anxious about little things. He couldn't make any attempt to control his world anymore. And his naturally sweet nature just blossomed, I would almost say again. And it was just so dear and so interesting to me, for me to perceive the difference between the intellect and the person. Even though he'd been so largely defined by his intellect and his ability to verbalize and all of those things, he lost it and became more himself. You know, it was more like he became the father that I remembered from my childhood. Because as a child, he couldn't relate to me with all that mind that he began to use as I became an adult, and he just related to me from his heart. And I just had always felt extremely well taken care of by my father. Whenever I see fathers and daughters, it always warms my heart, because he was a very loving father, and I felt I grew up with a healthy attitude toward men and toward life because he was such a nice man. But it's always stayed with me that what he really gave me was not really what he thought he was giving me. You know, as he grew older, I think he thought he was giving me his reason and his learning and his all of these things. But at the beginning, in the end, what he gave me was his heart. And that was so much more of who he was. And on one level, you would think it would have been a bad thing that he lost that intellectuality which had always defined him. On the other hand, I think it was a wonderful thing that he did, because it almost allowed him to just relax back into what was really more natural for him. Swami Kriyananda has made an interesting statement that love is the active expression of bliss. That when we feel bliss, there's a natural desire to share it. The real definition of joy and of a happy person is someone who wants to make everyone else as happy as you are. If people claim they are happy and they're not actively sharing that happiness and trying to make everyone else as happy as you are, then there's something missing about their happiness. Notably, that's how saints live. They try to make everyone else as happy as they are, because it's a bliss beyond. And of course, that bliss then translates itself into concern for others, which people would call love. So what I'm trying to say with all of this is when we let go of all that mental anxiety about everything and just relax back into what we naturally are, what we find at the center of our own selves is that our origin point is bliss, and the active, natural expression of that is to love. And it's easy, I mean, since we're talking about new parents here, but, you know, that's not John's position or mine. I never even raised children, never had children, so it's so easy these days to become obsessive about the details and actually imagine that the success or failure of your child is whether he sleeps on his side, his back, his left, or his right side, and whether the toy bounces or not, and, you know, just like we're so inundated with information. But all that we remember at the end of all of that is that open-hearted willingness, just the active expression of bliss. And the happier, you know, we allow ourselves to be, the more naturally active all that love is. Now, I mean, that's one part of it. The other things that we have to think about when we're thinking about, is there any questions? I mean, because we're so few of us, we don't have to have a lecture, we can have a conversation. Do you have any thoughts or responses to any of that? I mean, this was also my answer to the man who was having a second child. Don't worry. It's in your nature to be that way. Now, the difficulty is, though, we have so many conflicts in our relationships, don't we? You know, having said that, even just declaring that our nature is bliss and our nature is love, why is it such a mess to express it? You know, it's constantly bewildered me how complicated something so simple becomes. So moving away from newborn babies for a minute, which is a little hard to do with the energy in this room, but we're going to try to move back from newborn babies for a minute. And just think in bigger terms. You know, why are we drawn together? Why do we have children in the first place? What are we really trying to accomplish with one another? You know, we live in a Western world in which people think somehow that we're just born out of absolutely nothing and we hang around for a specified period of time and then we just disappear, which is so ludicrous that I'm not even going to give it serious attention. We're just going to have to start with the fundamental idea that the incarnations that we're living now, the incarnation your children are going to live, is a continuing story of something that began way beyond what any of us can even imagine and will continue until God realization is attained. So the first thing that we have to think about when we're thinking about the people in our lives now is we have to try to see even the most intimate and important relationships, mother-child, husband-wife, friend-to-friend, whatever it is, we have to see it in the right context. A great deal of the time we make terrible mistakes because we're just not seeing things in the right context. We have no perspective. I think spirituality, in many ways, a simple definition of it is just getting a perspective on things. And what keeps us from getting a perspective is, you know, the oldest trick in the book, which is that we are very, very close to a very limited reality. And whenever you've got something really close up, you know, your perspective on everything else gets really confused. So we've all lived in the bodies that we're inhabiting now. Your babies are growing bodies inside of you. They will live in those bodies for as long as you know them. The fact of those bodies makes you their parents, you know. That same soul could be born next door and it wouldn't be your child anymore. But what is actually your child about it? You know, it's a very peculiar thing when you think about it. So we have to ask ourselves on a much bigger level. We tend to think about our lives in very simple terms, and we're not wrong. We have a desire to be happy, and we have a desire not to suffer. And no matter how complicated the choices we make, the situations we find ourselves in, the successes or messes that happen around us, if you actually stand back, it's fascinating. It's always those two motivations and really nothing else. You know, maybe your parents are making the decisions for you for a long time in your life and you don't really feel you had a choice, but the choice you made was that it was easier to go along with your parents than it was to dispute your parents. So it's still the same choice of what creates happiness and what creates suffering. Some of you receive these, they used to be weekly, they're starting to be weekly again. I answer questions that are sent to me. And this woman sent me this question telling me that she was being forced to marry someone. I presume she was in India or somewhere where the culture of the parents made the decision. She was being forced to marry this person who wasn't her soulmate, and what should she do about it? I said, presumably if you're old enough to marry, you can walk on your own. You know, you're probably literate and can have a job. You may even have a passport. I mean, what do you mean force? What you mean is that you have to defy your parents and you don't want to. It's, you know, so because you're thinking that it would be worse to defy your parents than to marry this person, but what you're really just having is a hissy fit about these choices. I wrote her first, please don't marry this man. If you marry him only because you're forced to, every time he does anything that displeases you, you're going to tell him, I never wanted to marry you in the first place. I said, I must confess my pity is all for him. I mean, it'd be horrible. But, you know, it's just depending on how you look at it. But said, you're just, you know, this is your reality right now. But coming back to what I'm saying, everything is always from those two choices. I mean, you're having babies because you think it will in some way increase your happiness, conceivably decrease your suffering, if nothing else because your parents will be so pleased. You know, you have your lovely lady in Los Angeles and you've been up and down about your long-distance relationship, but you stay with it because no matter how much you suffer because of it, you also feel it's going to make you happier. And, you know, she's a lovely person, so I know why, even though you live at a distance from one another. Everything comes down to that. Every mistake we make in life is because we've misperceived. We've simply misperceived what will produce happiness and what will produce suffering. And because at the end, our origin point is bliss. And if we don't interfere with our natural consciousness, bliss will be what we experience. But we interfere with it all the time. Now, so the spiritual path is really very, very simple. It's not easy, so people assume it's complex. You see the difference? But it's very helpful to realize that it's not complex. It's just difficult to achieve. It's difficult to achieve for really simple reasons. We have very bad habits. We have habits that we've cultivated over many incarnations of a misunderstanding of where happiness comes from and what causes us suffering. And because of the nature of the way we're made, the chakras, and the way energy is stored in the chakras, and how the chakras being the astral body carries us from incarnation to incarnation. So even when this physical body goes away, we're still defined and attached to our astral body. So we go into the astral world, the energy universe. We hang out there for a while between incarnations. And then the pattern in our chakras of unfulfilled desires or unlearned lessons draws us back to incarnate into a physical body. I mean, there you both are. There was a moment of conception when somebody who is not really a baby, it just has a baby's body, somebody felt that the energy potential of entering your family, coming into your womb, would be exactly or sufficiently consistent with the energy pattern in their chakras that this was a good bet. Yogananda tried it, described it as a flash of lightning in the astral world, and he said all those souls in tune with that flash of light rush to get in. And, you know, usually just one makes it, sometimes two or three. A friend of mine, when I told her that story, she started to laugh. Her son, who's now in his 30s or even 40s now, she said when he was 5 years old, he got very angry at her, as children can do. And he announced that he didn't like her at all. And he walked out of the room, but he decided that was insufficient. So he came back and he declared, and they were not, there had been no training on a path of reincarnation or anything at that time. He said, "You weren't even my first choice." She became quite interested in her 5-year-old son. And she says, "Oh, is that so? Who was?" He said, "A lady in the Philippines, but she was taken." Like that, that's how he put it. So when I told her this story about souls competing to get in, she started laughing because she said her son has a very strong mind, a very strong nature, but he often hesitates just at the last moment. So she could see him in the astral world heading for that lady in the Philippines, then hesitating for a moment and then having it be taken and having to settle for her, as he was explaining to her at that point. But then the pattern of the chakras, which is the vrittis, the whirlpool of energy in the chakras, is the accumulated energy pattern of all of the individual's past thoughts, actions, feelings, everything. Every time you have a feeling, I became annoyed with David the other day. I don't usually become annoyed with him, but the phone was sitting right next to him, but it's the landline, and almost all the calls on that landline are for me. So he won't pick it up, even though it was right next to him, and I was really engaged in something else, and I just lost my temper, I have to actually say. It wasn't even my patience. I actually lost my temper, you know, and exclaimed with a great deal of force, something to do with the telephone that I won't completely repeat. But it was so interesting to me because it was such a strong force of energy, and I can be impatient, but I rarely really lose my temper like I did, and it was completely not worth it. But I could feel the energy of it go all through me, and I know that that strength of that energy stays with me. You know, I could really feel it. Even I thought, my God, what do people do who are really angry all the time? No wonder they have such bad health and so many other things. It just completely wrecks your system. But every thought, feeling, or action that we have because we are ego identified with it. Saints do not accrue karma, but all the rest of us do. Because when you ask, when you wake yourself up in the middle of the night and say, who am I? You give your name and you mean your body and you mean everything associated with it. We are identified with. So all of the actions and thoughts and feelings, not only in this incarnation, but in all our incarnations, register in the chakras. And the chakras from the base of the spine to the top of the spine, each of the chakras, without giving the whole definition of it, but each of them vibrates at a certain level of reality, you might say. And it's a reality from, I am a physical body, subject to birth and death, that my happiness comes entirely only for who I am and what I do, all the way to Christ consciousness, where I am one with the infinite spirit, I live in all bodies and in all creation. And every time you do anything, you know, this is the happiness, suffering, this is another principle, we are affirming some level of that reality. When I became impatient with David because he didn't answer the phone, because I can't stand the sound of that phone ringing and he could have picked it up, you know, it was like, first of all, I allowed the sound of the phone ringing to think that it actually had the power to take away my peace of mind. So I started with that. Then I started with the thought that David lives to please me, that he, you know, we share a house because his job is to do what I want him to do, which is a very bad supposition to start with. And then I thought that somehow some good would be accomplished if I spoke to him in a very unkind manner. You know, I was irritated by the phone, so I had irritation. If I pass some of that on to him, somehow I thought something good would happen. And all of this was affirming a certain level of reality, that my happiness can be disturbed, that if I can force him to behave how I want him, I'll be happy than I would be if I live in contentment. This is a level of reality. And the energy registers exactly on the vibration in which it's expressed. Now, this isn't about God's will, this isn't about sin, suffering, this isn't about damnation, salvation, nothing. It's just metaphysics. You know, whatever you do registers. And so you end up with, in the course of a lifetime, in the course of many incarnations, you end up with a pattern. And each of those vrittis is a whirling circle, chakra is a wheel of energy, and it creates magnetism, and the more you behave in a certain way, the more energy is drawn into that certain way. So we have risen to the point where we have this idea in our mind that generous-hearted, selfless kindness and love is really going to give us more happiness than the opposite. And of course, many people in the world think that controlling, self-gratifying, where everyone is subservient to me, where you behave the way I think you should, whether you're talking about your friends, your relatives, your children, or whoever it is, if I take from you, then I'll have more. I mean, that's a lower vibration. People build that up. We're more refined than that. But nonetheless, there's a lot of wrong actions in there that are still whirling around within us and creating magnetism. So when we get a little off center, we get sucked in. The sound of that phone ringing, what I did after that was I went around and I turned the ringer way down on all the phones because the origin point of my frustration was literally the sound of the phone ringing. So I thought, okay, what can I do to stop this? But somewhere, you know, the sound of a ringing phone was enough to disturb my peace of mind. And then I got off and then I fell into the habit of let me just try to make the person in my life who lives with me behave in the way I want him to, and that it seemed like a good idea at the time. It wasn't, but it seemed like it. Okay, so even though when all those vrittis are calmed, when all those whirlpools are resolved, what's left is bliss. That bliss is constantly being interrupted by those whirlpools. And so even though what we want is to be kind and generous and loving and forgiving and all of these things, I think of it as sort of like the feather that is our consciousness gets sucked into whatever way the wind is blowing. It's a little bit hard to keep it solid. So the actual literal reason, literally, why your babies responded to the flash of light in the astral world while we're incarnated here, is because those vrittis whirling made us restless in the astral world, because there's energy was pulling to have certain experiences that require a physical body in the material plane to have them. You know, whether they are hard lessons, easy lessons, joyful expressions or not, they force us. I think of it like this. Sometimes you'll say, I have the whole evening off. I think I'll have a long meditation, and, you know, then maybe I'll work on my art project, and then I'll read a good book. And then you're sort of sitting there, and you think, but first I'm a little hungry, and you open the refrigerator, and gee, there's not as much in there as you thought there was, and you start thinking about the pizza that you could get if you just went a few blocks down the road. And so you go out and you get the pizza, and then you run into one of your friends who's on his way out to a movie, and then you go to the movie, and then you get back home, and you sort of remember, oh yeah, I started out with a different intention, but then all these whirlpools of energy took me someplace else. Well, when we leave this body and go into the astral world, usually we're pretty happy to be there. But after a while, we begin to think about all these other things. So then we're drawn into circumstances that put us up against whatever unresolved energies we have, whatever we have committed our energy to that is truly less than self-realization. Now, of course, all of us are less than self-realization, so this is like not some big shocking piece of information. But we're brought into circumstances in which we have, a simple way to put it, is unlearned lessons. You know, just as simple as that. There's just something that we don't yet know. And the simplest way to say what we don't yet know is we don't yet know how to be perfectly blissful and uninterrupted channels for the active expression of that which is love. And so we get to have experiences which continually challenge us. And you know, Uma, you're even anticipating the challenge. And so, you know, it hasn't even started yet, but you're already anticipating the challenge. My friend with his second son was anticipating the challenge. It hadn't even begun, and yet he was already busy being worried about it. Jesus says, sufficient unto the day is the trouble thereof. There's no need to anticipate. But part of the vrittis is, am I going to be adequate? Will I do it right? You know, all of those different questions that come up. And those are among the many vrittis that we have to work out. Trust in God, trust in ourself, all of those different things. Yes, now.
So I had questions.
Sure.
Maybe two questions. So one, you mentioned about the mother and child relationship with respect to all the chakras and they being aligned. And that is why there is someone in my womb and they decided to be here, etc. But is that true with, like, between husband and wife or between any two people? Like, me and my friends, why are we friends? Because there must be some alignment along the line. And there must be some conflict. Why are we not totally aligned? We have some conflicts because in some chakras we don't.
Your chakras, as whirling fields of energy, create magnetism. And they create vibrations. This whole world is nothing but vibrations. And much more than we are aware of, everything that happens, because this world is only energy. This is Einstein's basic revelation. He declared that matter is not really there. It's just fields of energy vibrating. The implications of that are magnificent. That means that absolutely nothing is fixed. It's all mutable by the application of energy. And everything that happens to us is really the way these energy fields play together. Swami Kriyananda recently, in talking about true education and the direction that education needs to go, is especially, it's already being discovered nowadays. I'll come back to what you're saying, because this is part of it. There's so much information now, and information is changing so fast. One of my friends who graduated with a degree in computers, you know, like 15 years ago, her degree is absolutely useless, because everything has shifted so much. She's not in that field, but if she wanted to go back into it, she'd basically have to start over. You know, by the time you graduate, your field is obsolete. Some genius somewhere has made you completely obsolete. He's just taken it in a new direction. In our school, I mean, we really have a question, what do we teach these children? But what you really want to teach, what real education is how to have the right kind of magnetism. Because if you have the right kind of magnetism, then you can attract both knowledge, opportunity, money, everything. Now, of course, That doesn't mean you can be ignorant, because part of magnetism is knowledge and understanding. But between yourself and your friends, between yourself and your baby, between your husband and yourself, and there's magnetic, there's the energy of who you are is constantly vibrating. And now they have sophisticated ways of measuring this. And I saw this man, I can't remember what his subject was, but it was the biology of feeling in essence. And he showed pictures of people like us. If you took a snapshot of this room, this is what we look like. And you know, there's distance between all of us. But then he took a picture of the energy of this room, and all of our auras are overlapping. Because our energy field is bigger than our bodies, and our energies are mingling in all sorts of ways. And so, and in fact, that energy can go across the world. It's not limited by space, because power of thought and more subtle vibrations. So we find our affinities. And those affinities are sometimes the affinities of harmony and happiness, but they can also be the affinities of antagonism and unforgiveness. Because if you're vibrating strongly, if you're holding a strong thought towards someone or toward a certain expression, that too has magnetism and will draw you into it. As Yogananda put it in a most depressing way, he said sometimes we reincarnate in families where we're enemies in order to, as he put it, fight it out in close quarters, you know? So we naturally hope and assume that our own children and our parents, they will all be friends. This one woman told me this extremely difficult story that she'd had to face her whole life, or for much of her adult life. She gave birth to twins. One of them was a soul friend and one was a deep enemy. And from the moment they were born, she had a completely different response to each of the babies. And it was an affinity, but not a positive affinity. You know, the two souls had been intensely preoccupied with one another in a negative way. And it was an unlearned lesson. Amazing. Like that. Now, I don't want to curse you. Let's assume that your babies are your friends. Or if they're not your friends, let's say they're going to become your good friends. You know, but this is your first child, but you know, people who have multiple children, you have different relationships with each one. And yes, all your friends. And the more karmic affinity you have for one another, but that doesn't mean that you're identical necessarily. It just means that your energies and your vibrations go together. You know, and so even though, you know, your long distance relationship, the circumstances don't favor it, but the vibrations between you are so strong that geography just hasn't been able to break it. You know, my husband and I have very different personalities. And, you know, certain fundamental characteristics about him and about me are very different from one another. But from the very first, there's always been an affinity between us, a magnetic harmony that our vibrations work together. That when we first were living together, we lived together in one very small room. And when it was a little house, it was a very one-room house. But I was very pleased by the fact that our vibrations were so harmonious that it wasn't a difficulty to be in such a space together. It's not always required, but yes, exactly what you're saying is true. And you can also realize that that can be willed, that can be an act of will. It doesn't have, it's nice if it's natural, but it can also be an act of will. And when we understand getting along with each other is not just this lucky accident, or this sexual chemistry, or this, you know, sort of, you know, great passionate adoration of one another, which is okay, but sometimes that's actually, in the end, so confining and so ego-driven that it's not nearly as satisfying as just developing a vibrational harmony between you, which is developed from many different levels. Does that make sense? Whenever I speak of my husband, I said, you know, his character is what drew me. I mean, I love his personality. I enjoy him very much, but it was not really primarily a personality-driven relationship. It was on a deeper level. It was a vibrational connection. So yes, that's exactly true.
So, along with the same lines, I mean, you know that these days there is social networking.
Right.
And there is, like, some people around me define their friendships based on how many people they contact on social networking sites,
right,
and how many people they are in touch with. And some of those people are, they are my close friends, but I'm not on those sites, for example, and I do not believe in that.
Right.
I do not believe those are real relationships. And I feel that the love you have for your friends cannot be expressed by writing a message and declaring it to the world that, oh, I love you, kind of a thing.
Right.
And that's true with like my own husband as well. I mean, we don't email each other to tell what we feel about each other and so on and so forth. But what I've realized is love and the kind of feelings you have towards your friends, it's not symmetric.
Right.
So sometimes you might feel that, oh, she's my best friend.
Right.
But you may not be her best friend.
Yes.
But you want to be open with her about everything, and you want her to be open with you regarding her problems, and you can see that she's suffering with something. But if she doesn't open up, like, what should be your sort of response? Or what, like, with me, with some of my friends who I consider my best friends, they have not been open with me, and I want them to be open with me. I want to listen to everything they want to say, and they don't just tell me everything and anything that's going on, and I feel very, very sad about it. So I have just settled with the fact that they are a very close person. Like, they will not open up ever.
Okay.
And
well,
just
so coming.
See,
one of the natural things that causes the most difficulty in relationships between parents and children and romantic partners and friends is that we imagine that the people are there to make us feel a certain way. You have to measure everything by the image of Divine Mother that you have. The relationship of a mother, especially a Divine Mother, is that they're there to give. And that we find as we, I mean, the great power of parental love is that it has to be completely selfless. My friend, one of my friends who raised two sons who were born 2 years apart, and they came slightly later in his life, he said, I always thought I was kind of an unselfish guy. And, you know, by any standard he was. He said, I didn't realize that unselfish means absolutely no self, just zero, until he was raising two boys. And there was nothing in it for him. I mean, yes, you can say it was gratifying, it was this or it was that, both boys have turned out well and all of that. But still, he said, day after day, year after year, there was nothing in it for him. It was all just a direction of energy going out. And the satisfaction that he had, which was profound, was just simply that he was able to do that for them. Okay? Now, mother love is actually the ideal of all love. And we make a mistake because we don't realize that. Because mother love, literally, you give your body. I've never had children, and my body, for that reason, hasn't been as drained as my dear friend who's given birth to four children. You know, just the difference in our bodies at the same age is to a very large extent because she's had four babies and I've never been pregnant. I mean, just literally, you sacrifice everything that you call yourself. Once the baby is born, you know, the baby will die unless you take care of it. You know, absolute dependency, total sacrifice of your reality. Many beautiful myths and many beautiful cultures are all based on the serpent eating the moon, and the moon is the parent and the serpent is the child. Just consumes you. My friend with his two sons, he's devoted most of his life to earning the money necessary to raise them and send them to school. You know, but he's very happy because he did it. But there you are. But one of the mistakes that we make and that causes us the most trouble is that we need people to behave a certain way, because if they don't behave that way, it causes us pain. And that is the biggest, most gigantic, most all-consuming, unlearned lesson that we carry around, is that we make our happiness dependent on somebody else's behavior, and we become persuaded that we have some kind of a right to try to make them behave that way. Now, don't misunderstand me. If you're raising a child, you have very definite responsibilities. I see people take this principle, apply it to parenthood, and just make a mess of raising their children because they don't understand what the duties and responsibilities of parenting are. You know, this child has come to you and it needs to be trained, and you need to You know, lay down a line and hold to that line. So in that sense, you do have to impose. If you have friendships, if you have intimate relationships, you need to be able to behave appropriately. Which is, if people behave in a way that is not right, you don't have to put up with that in the name of love. I mean, we talk about that in modern psychology a lot. But that doesn't mean that you stop loving them. It just means that you don't have to go along with that. Now, you're telling me that you want your friends to be a certain way and they're not responding accordingly. So who are we talking about here? Are we talking about our friends, or are we talking about you? And is it that you really could help your friends? Now, if you really want to help your friends, you have to understand how to magnetize from them the kind of confidence in you you would like them to have. But if they are not showing that kind of confidence in you, it's easy to say it's their fault. But regardless, they're not showing that kind of confidence in you. So you have to intuit whether or not it's the way you're behaving, that they're open to others but not to you, or whether they don't know how to be open. And then you have to decide whether it's even right for you to try to persuade them to be so. You know, I remember I had a long sort of tussle with David, went on for about a year. You know, those of you who are more newly married don't understand how these things work over long periods of time. But I was just, you know, subliminally displeased with him. I wanted him to be different than he was in a certain fundamental way. After about a year, it got a little tiresome. And so I sort of essentially asked him a few questions like, do you know what it is that I want from you? Oh, yes, he said. I said, do you think it's a good idea? Oh, yes, he said. I said, well, why aren't you going along with me? And he said, because it's not my own priority. You know, there's many different directions that a person can go in their life, and I'm not inspired from within what you're trying to impose on me from the outside. Oh my, was that ever a helpful remark? It was so helpful to me. Because it made it in this respect, I wasn't wrong. It wasn't like the ideas that I had how we ought to behave were bad ideas. They were perfectly fine ideas, but they weren't his ideas. And so, you know, he if you're really a friend with someone, you have to support the way they feel to go in their life, not the way you think they ought to go. If your directions are too separate, then you may have to put physical distance between you. But if they're not that separate, they're just difference of opinion or difference of timing, or your methods are so tacky they're never going to get anywhere. You know, Swami Kriyananda has emphasized that marriage is much too close a relationship for one or the other to be the teacher. You know, you have to just be friends. And I say to the women in the room and other women who may hear this, it's a very rare, indeed perhaps non-existent man who likes to be led around by the nose by his wife. You know, men will fight you to the death merely not to be dominated. And it rarely, rarely works in a relationship when the woman is too bossy. It just doesn't. Men are not constituted to be henpecked. And women love to tell men what to do. It's a very complicated situation. But if you're, you know, go ahead.
Does it have to do with certain kind of vibrations that a woman's body or biologically has with the souls out there?
what did you mean by that?
I just mean that, so biologically, outward facing in this material world,
I see.
Due to whatever reasons, women behave in a certain way and
yes.
men behave in a certain
yes.
way.
Uh-huh.
Probably it has to do with evolution.
Yeah.
And as you were saying, the astral body and souls rushing in.
Right.
Does that flash of light also give a flag, or it's a man or a woman?
Well, it's a choice.
So the certain souls with having certain kind of things right. Rush to, it's a woman that is going to be born, so run there.
Well, it's the opposite. There's the flash of light, and you go in as the gender that that's appropriate for you for the lessons that you need to learn. Yes, exactly the truth. I mean, in this exact male-female question, which is a very interesting one, and you don't know whether you'll be raising sons or daughters, or maybe you do. Do you know the gender of your baby? What do you have?
It's a boy.
And what do you have? Do you know?
And
Okay. All right then. No problem. Okay. Not a problem. But in any well, you have a 50-50 chance of being right, as they say. But in any case, what I was saying is, I went through a period, I used to do a lot of marriage counseling, I don't really do much anymore, but a lot of women were coming to me, and after a while, there was a certain pattern in their complaints that I began to realize, and their complaints were this: everything about their husband was wonderful, except just a tiny little sort of bit of, you know, this much. But the difference, the little bit that they wanted to change was fundamentally the difference between male and female. If he was just a little more expressive of his feelings, a little more talkative to me in this way, a little more sensitive in this respect. And I had, again, my husband has been a great teacher for me, because I finally realized at one point that I was playing out exactly the same game. He was wonderful in every way except this little segment here. And if he would just change in this way, and essentially what he finally said to me is, I'm not going to, I don't want to, I don't even think it's attractive, you know, which was even the last part of it. Because, you know, I live with you and you're a woman and you're fine, but I'm not a woman and I don't want to be one. You know, I'm not really anxious to become constantly aware of my feelings and always being discussing them and knowing all the nuances of how I feel today and how I felt yesterday and why I'm going to feel different tomorrow and what might happen in between. You know, it's just like the male, yeah, men, they just look to the horizon, they go forward, and they're not really concerned about all the waxing and waning. You know, the man is the sun, the woman is the moon. The moon waxes and wanes and waxes and wanes, and she's always preoccupied, and he's just trying to make it through. You know, the traditional picture, which is not followed anymore, of, you know, the man goes out and conquers the world and the woman stays home and makes the nest. You know, when you conquer the world, you can't be thinking all the time about how you feel this morning. You really can't. A person, a soul who chooses to incarnate in a male body, wants to be a male as a rule. And when the woman in his life tries to make him into a woman, as a rule, he doesn't want to do it. And he's not really being obstinate, nor is he being wrong. It's not his destiny. And it's very annoying to women, just unbelievably annoying to women, because you think he's doing it on purpose, because you can see that it's just this much. But that much is a derailment often of their own true destiny. And the hardest thing for friends, the hardest thing for marriage partners, the hardest thing for parents is to genuinely guide and support a person to go in the direction that their own destiny is trying to take them, and not to feel that the direction of their destiny must be a certain way or else I will suffer. And then not to act from the fact that the direction of their destiny makes me nervous, and therefore I want it to be different. And the only way you can come to that, the only way, is to come into the right relationship with your own inner reality. All difficulties in relationships are because the individuals are not in right relationship to their own inner reality. Feeling a lack and having that lack, the experience of that lack happens sequentially with behaviors of the people around them. The person imagines that the behavior around them has caused the suffering. You know, the phone is ringing, I can't stand it, he doesn't answer the phone. I want him to answer the phone, my pain is caused by him not answering the phone. Maybe if I pass some of it on to him, I'll feel better. Complete madness when you take it apart, but in the moment it all made perfect sense. Right, Rohit, do you have a thought?
No.
Okay, any thoughts or comments or questions? Otherwise.
So I was thinking about this, what you're saying, and what I'm considering is that every individual in the world has a perfect view of, all a view that he considers to be a perfect view of the world around him. Uh-huh. And that's what he tries to achieve.
Right.
Like a woman wants a perfect relationship, and that's how the husband should be, that's how should the kids should be, or the friends should be, and so on. And every man has a perfect view of a world of how the relationship should go and so on. And there's some amount of difference between the perfect world,
right,
and that causes different issues with the relationships and everything.
Right.
So the point is, there should be some understanding that not everything in the world will be perfect. And to live in harmony with that whole concept of a partially perfect or a partially imperfect world?
Well, yes. The difficulty is that many people rebel against that articulation because they don't want to settle. That's the word. They don't want to settle for imperfect. So you can make that statement in ways that don't trigger that kind of rebellion against it. And then, both for yourself and for others, it works better. There's two parts to this. One part of it is, what is perfection? See, people tend to think of perfection as a static achievement of certain conditions that in this moment satisfy my needs, desires, and make me happy. There is nothing static in this world. Nothing. In the very moment that you say it, it's already passed. So no concept of perfection can be anything but a flow of energy, which is to say right attitudes, mental agility, generosity of spirit, self-control, that allow you to deal with the ever-changing reality in a way that produces more harmony than disharmony.
Right.
So perfection then becomes more of an internal personal attitude rather than external conditions, because external conditions can never be brought to a state of perfection. You're about to have these babies, which we call babies. They're not babies at all. They're fully manifested, complete individuals whose bodies are going to be small for a while. And you will see in no time at all they won't be babies. I mean, it's amazing to me. I look around. I mean, you're small women, both of you, and have these little tiny things. Look at how big John is. He was in his mother's womb at some point. You know, it's just like it's so incredible to think about that. But you see, where are you going to say that it was perfect? It has to be a flow of energy for the concept of perfection. That's half of it. The other half of it is this. In our Education for Life school system, Swamiji has made a definition. The purpose of education is to bring people to true maturity, not merely to knowledge, but to true maturity. And true maturity is the ability to relate to realities other than your own. So what Sandeep, what you just described, which is everybody has their own perspective on reality, the immature person can relate only to their own reality. And it's a beginning step to realize that we all have one. But the mature person is able to relate to realities other than their own. The female can relate to the male to the female, the parent to the child to his adult mother, the strong, vigorous son to his dying father. You know, my father had a reality before, now he has another reality. I, as the son, need my father to be strong, but now he's an old, dying man. And the ability to relate to a reality other than your own reality is true maturity and the real secret of being able to love. And then you, that's very dynamic. Because the reality today is not the reality tomorrow. The reality now is not the reality in 50 years. And so what perfection is being able to tune into that and always be able to move out of how I see it and really see what their reality is and then work from that. You know, your best friends are the ones who are able to see it from your point of view. Isn't that so? And even though they may lend their point of view to it, they do it appropriately and they do it with sensitive awareness. They're not always just trying to impose their reality on you. I mean, ideal parents are parents who are able to see the reality of the child, whether it's you're only 2 years old, naturally that's what you do. One of my friends, a boy who lived in a group house that we had, he was about two, and he was at the stage where every time he sat down to dinner, he knocked the glass of milk over, you know, just and it would just flood the whole dinner table. And the father became a little impatient, you know, the 10th or 12th time it happened. And the little boy, with that wisdom that sometimes children give you, he looked at his father and he said, "When you were the baby and I was the father, I didn't lose my temper." You know, he was still detached enough to see something that his father couldn't see. Yeah, were you going to...
You mentioned about how everything is energy, and Einstein talked about that, and many people have spoken about that over time. And it's very interesting. You know, they talk about the Eisenberg principle, right? You know, observing matter at subatomic level. And the scientists that are observing these particles, so to say, their presence and their behavior was determined upon the observer they noticed. So, for example, if these quarks were vibrating in a particular way, positive or negative, it depended upon the observer, and sometimes they would just not show up. And when the observer somehow decided, okay, they're going to show up, they would show up and behave according to that. So it's very interesting if life can be affected by thought, so if they're able to affect the behavior of life at that level, how much it is that we naturally do it constantly all the time. And then even to go further into maybe realizing that, you know, with energy and you're just really looking at a reflection of yourself when you're looking at somebody else.
Right, right.
Therefore, you're influencing that relationship with love or not. And maybe ultimately for the lessons that you need to learn in order to rise up to the ultimate gift, which is your God self.
Right. Now, excuse me, go ahead. I mean, the last piece of that is you can't experience it directly in exact proportion to how strongly identified you are with your own ego. The more you've transcended your own ego, the more you're able to actually experience realities other than your own ego. True maturity is the ability to relate to realities other than your own. And that actually has an enormous Vedantic implication, because there is a point at which you can, there is, all realities are your own. And so it's directional. And depending on the degree to which we have allowed our own thoughts and feelings to influence us, I'll keep coming back to the telephone because it was my most recent adventure. He had very good reasons for not wanting to answer the phone. His reasons were just as valid as mine. But in the moment, the only reality I could relate to was my reasons, not his. It was just as simple as that, because I was deeply ego-identified with my feelings at that moment. They were the only realities there were, and I just wanted him to behave according to mine. I mean, and it was a moment of disharmony in myself. But it happens all the time. Somebody says something and you draw conclusions from it that are about you. And you completely, haven't you ever had that? You talk to someone and suddenly they twist the conversation and they don't understand what you said because they've drawn it so quickly in a direction that's meaningful to them that they've completely missed what you were going to say. I don't mean to say this is at all true, but this is sometimes why people don't confide in one another, in someone particularly, because every time I talk to them, they answer from their reality. They don't see my reality. This is why children often don't talk to their parents, because their parents cannot perceive their reality. My nephew, the age of 20 or so, was talking to me about, I have this relationship with him as an aunt, which is you know, more than a friend but not a mother. It's a really nifty way, especially since his mother and I are sisters. So I'm slightly like his mother but not his mother. It's fun. It's a very fun relationship. And he talked about his mother and his parents in general, about their anxiety about the possible consequences of certain behaviors, certain actions he was contemplating. And he said, very astutely, he said, they don't realize that even if what they expect to happen does happen, I have the energy and the creativity to deal with it. And it was a very strong thought, because I vividly then remembered conversation with my own father when I was exactly his age. And my father was very concerned. I was taking this apartment on my own and various things. And he was very concerned because he'd done the math and he didn't see how it was going to work out. He was really anxious that it wasn't going to work out. I was actually not at all certain that it would work out, but I had no anxiety about it not working out. Because if it did, I had the energy and the creativity to do something about it. And whereas for him it would have been a problem, for me it was an adventure. You see how huge the difference is? And just, oh my goodness. how often we just impose upon one situation. I used to laugh about this. You know, all parents are footloose and fancy-free until they become parents. Then they have to plan and they have to work. Then they become stodgy and their children are annoyed with them for planning and working and becoming stodgy, which is imposed upon them by their children. You know, just like it's so unfair. But children have no concept of the extent to which parents facilitate their world and how much energy and commitment that takes. And at some point I realized that and I stopped being annoyed with my parents for being parents. You know, but still, you see, the same reality. Where does it end? Yeah. If you're really in someone else's reality, if you're really sensitive to someone else's reality, even if you disagree, there's no disharmony. Because there's it's just the truth. You may not be able to progress in the way that you wanted to progress, but nonetheless, it's just an honest place to be. It's when we refuse to see each other's realities or to relate to it properly, the difficulties come. Now, let's take a break. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. So that makes us to 11. Is it? It's cool in here. Are you all uncomfortable? Do we need to turn? It's too cool?
No.
Okay.
You have a great sense of verbalizing thoughts, so
go ahead.
Yes, you are a woman.
Absolutely. Definitely the truth. Break. Say your name correctly for me.
Manasi.
Raised a couple of very interesting points that I thought was a good starting point. And it's related to everything else we've been saying. So, because, you know, there's just so many directions to go. Since all of you have romantic partners, then this is worth thinking about. Swami Kriyananda made this statement once in the middle of a class about marriage and relationships. And it was one of those things where it took us all just a minute to hear it. So the laughter kind of caught up. He finally had to pause a few minutes later. And he said, the great tragedy in almost all marriages is that he thinks she'll never change, and she does, and that she assumes he will change, and he doesn't. And that's pretty much the way it goes. Now, the other side of that is there's often an effort made, and it's usually the woman is making an effort to change the man, but not always. But there's this thought in your mind, and this is where it comes in, and it's very serious. If you really loved me, you would do this. And it's a very subtle and quite confusing thing and very important to get straight. I've been married twice. And the first time I married, I was 19 years old, and in, you know, the traditional American fashion, which is nothing to be proud of, but this is what we do. We practice on one marriage, and then we have a real marriage. So I lasted 5 years, and then we separated and divorced. And about 10 years later, I married David, and now it's been 30, so this has been the real one. But in that first marriage, in that case, it was reversed. He was very strong-minded. Let me just, you know, it was a very real connection. I think any matchmaker would have put us together. We were perfectly suited for each other. We just didn't have any idea how to conduct ourselves in that relationship. And his destiny wasn't Ananda, and mine was. So that's really what broke us apart. But we conducted the relationship in a completely ridiculous way in retrospect. Which is, he was very strong-minded. He had very strong opinions about how everything should be, including how I should behave. And I was actually looking for a guru, not a husband. And so I essentially discipled myself to him. But he was not Lord Rama. So being Lord Sita was not entirely appropriate, being Sita. But I thought, well, you know, he had good ideas, and I would try to behave the way he behaved because I loved him. And so he was immature enough to use that thought, or even to articulate that thought, if you really love me, you will do X, Y, and Z. So I tried, seriously, to mold my personality and my way of being, and nothing he asked of me was evil in any respect. It was just to modify myself. Until it would just, you know, the whole thing became so out of balance, I just couldn't do it anymore. So 10 years pass, and then I marry again. And I'm trying to learn. I don't want to blow up this relationship, too. And I began to realize that it isn't a question of whether you love someone or not. It's a question of whether you even have it in you to make that kind of a change, whether it's an appropriate request, a desirable request, whether it's in tune with your reality, and whether you have the willpower to do it. It has nothing to do with whether you love each other. And there's this huge inclination to say, if you loved me, you would. Now, I'm not talking about things like, you know, infidelity or abuse. I'm talking more just about personality inclinations like this. So when I was, you know, when David and I were making the decision, you know, to have a life together, I mean, I jokingly, but not really, I said certain things to him like, you know, I don't like to clean houses. I mean, cleaning a house is like, I can hardly imagine ever having nothing else to do, that I would vacuum or dust or anything like that. I just loathe that kind of work. I will do the dishes, I will cook, I will take care of the clothes, but I will never pick up the vacuum cleaner. David, very energetic person, and for many years of our life, he just did the housework. It was fine. Finally, we just hired a housekeeper. I said, I'll do more work to earn money, to hire somebody rather than do it myself. But so he did all the housework. And then after a while, after we'd been together a number of years, he very sweetly and very appropriately in just the right way asked me whether or not I would clean out the bathtub sometimes. First of all, I was very myopic at the time, and I didn't even know the bathtub was ever dirty because whenever I was in it, I didn't have my glasses on. It looked fine to me. So I had to put on my glasses and go look at it, you know, to see whether it was dirty. So that was the first part of the problem. I didn't even know. But I thought about it quite seriously, and I basically said, not likely, because I don't think I could discipline myself to clean that bathtub. I just don't want to do it. It's just not in me to do it. Doesn't have anything to do with the relationship. And I began to realize, and then I reversed it on him many, 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 many times. You know, I learned it more when he brought it to me because I was conscious of my own feelings, but I reversed it on him as I've described. And I realized there's two sides to it. One is, you know, you have to have the maturity to know what is a reasonable request, you know, and the maturity to know yourself, to know what's really important to you. And basically, don't squander your requests on trivial things. You know, if it's really fundamental, I need you to get a job. I can't take care of everything in this household. I need you to stop drinking. You know, these are really big requests. But a whole bunch of other stuff is just a matter of preference. And you don't want to make your relationship, always putting the relationship on the line for trivia. And to ask of people things that they don't want to give, or even more, that they're simply incapable of giving. And part of that, you just really have to know who you're with. You have to really know who your friends are. There's a tradition, you know, they call it the seven-year itch. And I don't know, it's an awful phrase, but that's just sort of the idea that relationships break up at 7 years in America, where relationships break up. And whether they break up or not, I actually have noticed something about 7 years. 7 years is the point at which all of your illusions are gone. And every effort you've made to make that person into somebody else has proved futile. And they are relaxed enough with you that they're just going to be themselves every single day of the life. Your own sort of excitement that now, you know, I have a friend, I have a partner, whatever it might be, has settled down enough that you're back to your own normal state of consciousness too. I call it the thunk, the big thunk, when everything just finally hits reality. And you sort of wake up and you look across at the person you're living with and you realize, this is it, you know? Whatever is in front of me is really it. And if you can relax and enjoy that, then you can go on for a long time. But if at that point you panic because you didn't really know what you were getting, you really hoped that he would change, or you hoped that you wouldn't, all of those factors, the effect of having children, of not being as successful as you expected, all those different points. It's just, you're in your own reality and you have to deal with it. And the sooner you can come to that, the happier you can be. The way I came to peace with it in myself was really simply this. If this is really what is here, in this friendship, this relationship, this motherhood, whatever it might be, would I rather have just this, or would I rather live without it? Because there's what I call the mythical third alternative, which is that reality is going to shift according to my desire. Which is, it'll be just this man, but he'll be just this much different. It'll be just this woman, but she'll be just this much different. You know, she'll be 10 years younger and more beautiful like she was when I married her. You know, she won't be worn out with the children. You know, she'll be as sweet and attentive and as adoring of me as she was when we first met. You know, none of those things are there. So is it like 51% more desirable to have what you have than to not have it at all? And using that as a criteria for all your decisions is actually very, very interesting. You know, when you're wanting to press and try to get something from whoever you love, whether it's your friend or your child or whoever, you know, is it worth it? Is it really worth it? Parenting is slightly different because you have standards you have to impose. But is it really worth it? Does it really matter whether they do? And if it does, then you have to stand up, because some things do matter. Some are not a matter of opinion. Some are a matter of character and principle. And you, at certain points, you have to draw the line and say, it compromises my soul to go beyond this. But people are always acting as if their soul is compromised when it's really nothing except convenience, opinion, expectation. Does that make sense? Does that help? Does that help with what you're talking about? And it's very, very annoying when whoever doesn't respond when you really think they ought to. And all I can say is that's why you're together. Because that's the cutting edge of your own learning. That's where you have allowed someone else's behavior to define your happiness, and you've put yourself in a position where you will suffer unless somebody else does something that you have decided they should do, that they have not spontaneously offered to you, but that you are trying to make happen. Just watch it all the way through your life. You'll see how many times that comes to be. Now, that doesn't mean you can't help other people go in directions that are good for them, but you have to help them, as you were saying, as we were saying in that thought, by magnetizing them, by inspiring them. I read something that Swami Kriyananda said about his own leadership. It was such a beautiful thought. He said, I feel that I'm here to inspire people, not to correct them. And then more recently he said, no one changes from being scolded. He said, they change from coming to a higher understanding. And he said, if you just share with people your bliss, then they will come to the understanding. It was a really interesting thought. And we scold ourselves all the time. I mean, even, you know, your inclination to worry about whether or not you'll be a good mother or not, you know, you're sort of hoping that anxiety or over-scrupulosity will make you something that you're not. But you are and you will be a good mother because you're a very loving, sweet person, and that's all that really matters. You know, the rest of it is, it won't change. You know, the same principles work on ourselves as they work with other people. Does that make sense? Are there any thoughts or comments or questions on any of that? You know, there's also a great tendency to become quite alarmed when we're confronted with our limitations. You know, when we realize that I've lost my temper, or I really do want something and I can't let go of that desire, whether it's that a person change or, as you were talking about, that your husband do this particular favor that he's just not inclined to do. It's so interesting to me, that particular conversation, or David asking me to clean out the bathtub or whatever it might be. If something's easy for you, it's just easy for you, and you imagine that it's easy for everyone else. And it's very strange, the blocks that we have. I mean, what she has asked of you for her is so simple and so easy, it's hard to comprehend why he wouldn't do it. When I wanted David to answer the telephone, it seemed so easy to me to answer it, and yet in his own mind it loomed. His perception of exactly the same situation for all of the vrittis in his chakras, for all those reasons, was a really different reality. The children that you're giving birth to now, I mean, what kind of a world are they actually going to grow up into? I again remember with my father, him wanting me. At that point, you know, I was in high school in America when President Kennedy was assassinated. And then we had Richard Nixon after a while, and he had to resign because he was dishonorable and so on. And those were really big deals in American culture growing up. They were really the beginning of the tearing of the fabric of respect for government and authority and so on. And when I began to come of age, my father wanted me to essentially, naturally, he wanted me to join the mainstream of society in some way or another. And I remember trying to explain to him how and why those events had made me not interested, that I really couldn't, I just couldn't do it. And it was so interesting to me to watch because his reality was so different. You know, he'd grown up in a completely different way with a completely different expectation of things. I, of course, found Ananda and never did enter that world at all, ever. I came to Ananda when I was 22 and I've never left, so 24 and I've never left. So, but everybody has a particular spot. And now we're so multicultural. You know, you were talking about being raised Indian with all of that orientation that it has, and you're going to bring up a child in America. Send a child, if you do stay here, send a child to school where his influences will be so different than the influences that you have. You may be able to maintain a certain amount, but the underlying assumption that those things will even be of interest to the child, what to speak, be attractive, or have him want them. And I know, you know, with Sharonda's children, you know, they live in a completely different world in which your experience is like from another planet. And even though it's highly desirable what you have to offer, it is not their reality. I was impressed in just a celebrity interview, which, you know, for the most part is meaningless, but I was impressed by it. It was with Meryl Streep, who apparently has raised 3 or 4 children. And she was talking about, she's a very educated woman, and she was talking about just the natural affinity she had with the first children that she had. But whatever the third or fourth, the last one that was born, there were no shared interests. That he just wasn't of the same type as the other children, and all the things that they had all been able to share, her child just wasn't interested. So she, being a conscientious mother, simply took up the things that interest him. And she learned to snowboard, and they started to go skiing, and she just talked about just all these things. Another friend of mine, she was a single mom, and she was raising her son. And when her son entered high school, even though they'd been very close, he suddenly began to distance himself a little bit from her. And again, there was just a breakdown of shared interests. We had a passion for sports. So the one thing that they could do together was to sit and watch sports together. So she started reading the sports section of the page. She started reading the sports magazine. She became extremely knowledgeable, and they would sit together and watch sports, and she was able to really participate with him. And later on, he went off and went to college and then graduated from college. And then one year, he bought her a subscription to a sports magazine, at which point she confessed to him that her interest had only been in him. But the willingness to go that far, and to go that far so sincerely that he was persuaded that she actually cared, was a tremendous tribute to what mattered to her. And the more we understand that really that's all we're doing, we're just trying to be in other people's worlds. For me, as a girl with a very masculine mind, I've always had a masculine mind and a disinclination toward girl things. One year, when we were still living at Ananda Village, a good friend of mine was running. We had a woman's clothing store in town, and once a year they had a fashion show. And one year she asked me to be a model in that fashion show. And I did it just for the lark of it. And at the end of it, I said, this is the only thing in my entire life I have ever done just because I was a girl. You know, to just wear these clothes and walk up and down. It was a very small potatoes thing, but it was the only thing I'd ever done that was just like girl things. So as a consequence, I really had to learn to be friends with girls and friends with women. I really did not know how to be friends with women. I could be friends with men very easily, but women just bewildered me. And I had an intense aversion to what I considered to be superficial conversation. And so many women just wanted to chat. And I was just at sea. It wasn't even that I didn't like it. I just didn't even know where to begin. But I realized it was a problem because I just didn't know how to make friends with women. And so I apprenticed myself to a couple of women who were really good at being girls. And I practiced matching my vibration to their vibration. And that's the point that I'm going to bring here. I mean, I just tried, instead of thinking what my rhythm would be, what I wanted to say, how I wanted to put myself forward, the things that interest me, I just tried really hard to see where their vibration was going. And then just try to get into their vibration and listen to what they wanted to talk about and contribute to what they wanted to talk about and be interested in what to them seemed important. And it was an amazing learning for me. And as a consequence, I made some very good friends, some very good female friends, yes.
When you say following their vibrations, do you teach this as an advanced thing that you really see some vibrations and you can actually follow that through meditation or something? Or is it just a figure of speech kind of that?
No, it's literal. It's actually literal. That's a very good question. Swami Kriyananda raised the thought once that most misunderstanding, verbal misunderstanding, is a matter of rhythm. And I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, some of you speak Indian accented English, and when I go to India, there's a temptation to imitate it. And it's not entirely a wrong thing to do, because if you can speak in the same rhythm, then you can kind of hear what the vibration is. And a lot of times people are speaking English, but your mind is holding to the rhythm that you're used to. I mean, all of you have a different rhythm mostly than I have. But I've trained myself to not resist the rhythm of your language. And then if I don't resist the rhythm of your language, which is the vibration of your language, then I don't have any trouble understanding it. But it's almost like if I just relax and fall back into my own rhythm, I can't understand it. And I watch people, English speaking, who need English to English translation is what we call it, because they won't shift their vibration into it. So yes, it's quite literal. And it is an element of a benefit of meditation. Because when you meditate, literally what you're doing is you're withdrawing from all of the outward expressions of your nature, and you're coming simply back to your origin point, and the origin point is still. So if you can bring yourself back to that point of stillness, then from there you could go any direction. But if you're never habituated to bringing yourself back to stillness, but always just flowing with the outward moving energy, then you can't get out of it. It's really like the roads all emanate from this core point, but if you're out on this pathway and someone else is out on this pathway, you can't get there from here. You can only get there by going back to the origin point, and then you can easily extend yourself out, even if you can't imitate the accent, so to speak. You can just move out with that. So one of the tremendous secrets of being to love well, love deeply, and love harmoniously is being able to stand in quiet inside your own heart, having withdrawn and detached yourself to the degree that you can from your own habitual individual expression. Because from that point, you're also, like the fingers on a hand, you're back to the place, if you come back from the extension of the fingers, you get to the place where they all begin. And from here, this is where true unity comes from. And this, Sandeep, is partly the question you also asked, but everybody has their own reality. Depends how far out you are from your own center, how distinct that reality is, and how distant it is from others. If your own reality is deeply defined from your point of stillness and origin, then it's easy for you to embrace other people's realities. And that's the true maturity, and that's true education. you know, the difference between education for life that we offer in our schools and pretty much all other education is not really that we're kind in the classroom, they have conflict resolution or things like that, but that we teach the children to go back to their point of origin. And from that point of origin, and you know, that's not a parochial, that's not sectarian, that's just a fact. And one little girl came to school and told us, I'll tell you a couple of stories that way. She said, I was feeling really cranky this morning. She was six. And I was about to have a tantrum. She said, but then I decided to breathe instead, which is what she'd been taught in school. And she literally just started breathing, which brought her back to her center so she didn't have to have a tantrum. She's six. I mean, just think about the implications of that. There's another even more astonishing story from our school. It's a little boy, I think he was only five, and he was on an airplane with his mother, maybe with both his parents, and the plane really hit a really serious pocket of turbulence. I mean, so serious that even the crews were really scared. It was really a scary thing, and the plane was really bucking and bouncing and you know, they had everybody seated and people were screaming and it was very agitated. And the little boy, I think his mother said, you know, something. I think his mother either instructed him or he did it himself or suggested it. But he literally crossed his legs and started just meditating and concentrating on his breath as he'd learned to do in our kindergarten. And the incident went on for like 15 minutes. And he was completely calm through it all. Whereas everyone else, including his mother, was just really very, very agitated. And afterwards, the stewardess came over and said, where did he learn to do that? And she said, at the school he goes to. And the mother said to our principal, I need to learn whatever you've taught my son. But because he was accustomed to going back to his point of origin. Now, you know, both of these, but this is... our relationships get confused when we get way out on the periphery of who we are and then from that point try to reach others, but the gap is too wide. So that's the answer to it. You know, I do lots of things which are interesting. I mean, male-female is interesting, mother-child, parent-child. You know, imitate the physical reality of the person that you're working with. You know, I'll see someone and I'll notice they have a particular posture, a particular way of holding their head, a way of walking, particular mannerisms, things that they do with their hands. And sometimes if you try it, it'll give you a clue as to what kind of a vibration that person is going through. I mean, there's not all that much physical difference. Neither of you men are really big, but John is a big man. And every so often I think, with some of my male friends who are big men, I said, wow, everything about your life must be really different because you're a big, strong male person and I'm a rather small female person. I was blessing someone once at our Sunday service, as we do, and this man walked up to me, a very tall man. I'm up one step and we're eye to eye. And I realized, oh my word, this man walks through life and this is how he sees everything. And just even that little bit of a switch, to just think what it would be like to always be above everyone, you know, and always having to carry around just so much more force, being able to lift and move, and you know, that's the rhythm of it. All of those things are the rhythm. And if you can really stand back, even from your most intimate relationships, especially from your most intimate relationships, and as one of my friends very accurately put it, he said, when you live with someone, there's a tendency to consider that person to be merely an extension of your own mind. And so you don't really remember anymore that they're moving in their own reality. You see them as just an extension of whatever your reality is. And that comes to things like, why can't you do it? It's so simple. Why don't you answer the phone? Why don't you do this errand? Because you're just an extension of my mind and I would do it. But you're imposing your vibrations then on the other person's vibrations. And conversely, think how extremely gratifying it is when people actually get you for who you are and don't really try to have you be different than you are, but then even better, help you to become what you're trying to become. You know, where are you trying to go and how can I help take you there? But you see how much self-control and selfless inner satisfaction you have to already have. So the final secret of loving is meditation. Because the closer your relationship with God, the more you can relate to everyone else as God relates to them. The more distant you are from your own point of origin, the more easy it is to get scattered out into the periphery. Does that make sense? Thoughts, comments, questions, any? Right.
And that shows me that you love me.
Right.
That I don't expect this from others.
Right.
Because they don't love me. But so that satisfaction is harder to just have within there. I think that's where meditation helps. I know it's all within me, but to just go back into that thought is what is needs practice.
And it's not that the people who love you shouldn't be nice to you. For their sakes alone, they should be nice to you. And we also have to be very realistic. You know, I'm not capable, one has to say sometimes, you know. I've said it to friends and to my husband at different times, you know. This is simply more than I can handle. You know, I want to be big enough to be able to embrace this, but I can't. You know, this is a line I have to draw, and I don't know what you're going to do about it, but you need to know that I can't stretch beyond this. You know, it just happens sometimes that you do. So part of inner contentment, and this is where I was going to go a little while ago, is we have a lot to learn. And you have to also be very comfortable with your own limitations. You can't take all of this teaching and then just impose it upon yourself when it doesn't fit. You have to realize that that's where I'm going, but you also have to realize where you are and be very honest and realistic about what your limitations are. And sometimes in a relationship you have to say, this is really more than I can handle. And then I've had to say, I don't know what you're going to do about it. I'm not going to tell you what you have to do about it, but you know, I'm going to have to figure out what I'm going to do about it because this is simply more than I can handle. And then you have to really decide what you can do about it. And the great, you know, temptation is to become sad. But one of the realities we have to learn to relate to other than our own is the truth about life. And, you know, life is much less clear-cut than we think it's going to be. You know, we have these dreams when we're young about how simple it's going to be. We're going to manifest all these things, and then it just doesn't happen that way. And there are many things that are out of our control, even whether loved ones live or die is often out of our control. Whether economic conditions favor us or not is often out of our control. Whether people's health is maintained is often out of our control. Just the soul that we attract to be our child is often out of our control. You know, whether or not we even have children if we want them is out of our control. All of these different things. And so the great temptation in life is to let circumstances make us sad. And the great challenge in life is to be responsible for your own happiness. So this is what brings friendships and marriages and families to pieces all the time, is that individuals do not take responsibility for their own happiness. And it's not merely a question of it being a good idea. It's that it's just the only way to live. If anybody else is responsible for your happiness, you will not be happy. And the chances are they won't be either. I went through a very painful, which still hurts my heart a bit, you know, speaking of my father, who's now long since in the astral world. He was very attached to me. And a certain period of my life, especially through high school, we spent a lot of time together, and I gave him a lot of energy, and he gave me energy. That was the period of time when we were closest. And then, at the age of 18, I went off to college, and I never came back. I never spent more than a few days with my parents ever after that. I just sailed away and didn't come back. And I vividly remember, you know, how painful that was for my father. Just intensely painful, because I'd been his lovely daughter and he'd gotten a lot of happiness from me. And in the American way, you know, in the Indian way too, because you've all changed countries here, all of you have changed countries, left your parents behind. So the hope that they had of lifelong relationships with you have been certainly changed, if not interrupted. But I was also intensely aware of the degree to which my father had allowed his happiness to become tied up with me. And not to my credit, but I had to do it, I absolutely could not take responsibility for it. I just couldn't. I intuitively knew I had a different destiny, which has played itself out, of course, because not long after I came to Ananda and everything has happened from there. This was clearly my life. My life was not intended to be with my birth family. But the sense of being responsible for his happiness was just an unbearable burden for me. And I had to withdraw. I was talking not too long ago to a father whose child is about to go through that same thing, and the father's going through exactly the same experience. I tried to help the father to see it from his daughter's perspective, but it was too painful for him to do so. Now, that's so tricky, because at the same time, you've really got to give your heart to the people around you. And when I was first married to David, I had a really profound realization about this, because I managed to become emotionally upset about something that he hadn't even done. It was just me, just as women can do, just stirring up trouble, you know, just sort of silently becoming upset, which of course drives. Once I listened to David, at that time we lived in this dome, and it was really one room, but there was a sleeping loft and there was a sort of a half wall. So I was on the other side of the half wall, and he was talking to this young man who was having terrible romantic troubles with this pretty emotional woman that he was involved with. So I was there, but you know, I sort of got trapped up there. He didn't really know I was listening to the whole conversation. But he went on to describe this woman's behavior, which was, to my mind, a little over the edge, but not so far. David listened very attentively to the whole thing, and then his words of advice were, "That's women," just like that. It's like, what do you expect? That's what they're like, and that's what they are like. So I, being a woman, during that very same period of time, just created this huge trouble that David had not even caused, but I had just created it because of my emotional involvement in being married to him. And I was so bummed by my upset and the trouble I caused in the household that afterwards I thought to myself, well, you know, the reason that I got so upset is because I'm just too open to him. I've allowed myself to become too involved and all these things. So I thought, I'll just close up a little. You know, I'll just withdraw. And I thought, you know, we'd only been together like a couple of years. I said, if I solve the problems of my emotional involvement with him by decreasing our sense of closeness, by hardening my heart, I said, where will this ever end? You know, we've all seen older couples around us who have just, they live next to each other, but they don't live together. Because step by step, often the man, as Swami Kriyananda points out, has been driven into silence, and she just talks and talks and talks, and he's become hard of hearing, and he doesn't, you know. Or she's just so disappointed by his refusal to do what she wants, you know, that I didn't want to go there. That seemed like an awful place to end up. But I also didn't want to live in what I was living with, which was, because I was so tender, you know, any little fluctuation could just set me off. That was no fun either. So I had to think about it really, really deeply. And I used spiritual principles that are true in all circumstances, that I highly recommend this. Overall, and I'm just speaking for myself, and I know this isn't true for everyone, I'm not really afraid of what life might bring me. I mean, certain things certainly look unattractive to me, and no one wants physical pain or imprisonment or great disappointment, you know, so I can become tense at the thought of many things. but I don't have a deep-seated fear that this will happen or that will happen or so on. For a very simple reason, I assume if God sends it to me, he will send me the energy to deal with it. And he'll send me the inspiration to deal with it. I'm not expecting it to be easy, but if it's a challenge that comes to me in life, it's because it's the right challenge, and I will be able to face it, and I will be able to go through it. So it's not really other people that we put that I put my trust in. You know, I married an honorable man because I expected him to be honorable, and he is honorable. But who can say? You know, people get diseases, people get brain injuries, all kinds of things happen. Nobody can promise that nothing will change. So I can't just be comfortable because this person is going to do it for me, because what if for some reason he can't? But I can trust that God will act through the people in my life and simultaneously send me whatever I need to deal with it. And so, therefore, if that's what you're trusting, you don't have to protect yourself at all. You have the complete capacity to be absolutely open to people, to circumstances, to things in your life. You can give your heart completely because you're not really giving it to the person in front of you. You're giving it to the fact that God has brought this into your life and that you're giving it to him because he's the true source of whatever you're experiencing. Does that make sense? I mean, when you're having babies and your feelings are going to become so, you know, just, you know, unimaginably tender and involved, it's so easy at that point for a tremendous amount of fear to also come in. Or as you're talking about, just this deep-seated belief that I can't be okay unless this person behaves differently. That is the reason why we have all these relationships, because we have to get over that. And it doesn't matter if we keep falling into it. If we try to solve the problem by getting over it, not by trying to domineer and impose our will on someone else. You know, parents do it by becoming insanely overprotective of their children for fear of any little thing that might happen to them. And, you know, standing back objectively, you're not really being a good parent, even though the motivation in your mind is that I'm a good parent because I'm so protective. No, you're a good parent if you raise that child to be a strong individual. Yogananda says, really, you know, things that are almost shocking about parenting. He said, basically, he says, don't coddle your children. He said, help them to grow up tough. And, you know, that's like, we don't think like that. He said, basically, you know, don't always give them a sweater when they're cold. Don't always feed them when they're hungry. I mean, he's not advocating child abuse. But don't give them the impression that every little teeny tiny desire has to be fulfilled. Because if we grow up thinking that every teeny tiny desire has to be fulfilled, we don't grow up with any strength. You know, don't protect them from disappointment. You know, don't run around making sure that no little drop of rain ever falls on their lives. Be attentive, be reasonable, but recognize what you're really doing here. You're not taking care of a baby. You're raising a man or you're raising a woman, and you have to think about what will make that person into an effective man or a woman, not merely what will make that person, you know, make mother happy as a happy baby. You know, it's very, very different. And it requires that you come back into center and see things, see realities other than your own. Does that make sense? Do you have any thoughts or comments or questions on any of that?
Yeah, it's very powerful, and as I keep repeating about coming back to center, which helps one really overcome their limitations or their self-imposed limitation. And so coming back to center is perhaps remembering we were created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And what does that really mean? It's mm-hmm. enormous. Mm-hmm. We have the capacity to embody what that means mm-hmm. and the qualities of God. So is immense, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. and our ability to be disappointed becomes, you know, squashed, and maybe you mm-hmm. stop going through life looking for reasons to be annoyed.
Yeah, it's true.
And little things like that. It sounds so simple, but how often it is that we need to be reminded to come back to center, to meditate,
yeah.
to breathe, to meditate.
You know, to make it practical, let me just explain how it really works in a practical sense. And I mentioned this earlier, but it's very important. You have to realize you can't impose the entire solution on yourself because we're not standing there. But you can solve your problem in the right direction. Instead of thinking I have to squash all my desires and hopes and just take it, that doesn't really work because we're not, to suppress is not the same as to transcend. And if we're just merely suppressing because we're trying to be better than we are, as Swamiji says, the energy will just come out in some weird way later. That was essentially the story of that marriage I had that was 5 years. I just suppressed my own personality. And then when it finally burst the boundaries that I had set on it, it exploded like a, you know, like an atom bomb. So everything was fine and then it was completely incinerated. Because I had just suppressed so much energy, I hadn't really transformed. So even though we may know that this perfection is where we're going, we also have to be very comfortable with the fact that I'm not there yet, but I'm going to solve the problem by going toward that. You know, so maybe, for example, you have to say, I really can't handle this. But you don't say, you're such a terrible person. You know, if you really cared about me, you would treat me this way. Which is not solving it in the direction of I'm going to work on myself to make myself better, but solving it in the direction of if the whole world would just conform to my ideas, then I would be happy. You see, there are two different ways to go, but you may actually have to take the same action. You may have to speak frankly to someone and define something and express a feeling that you wish you didn't have, but you do. It makes me so upset when you do that, you know. I would rather it didn't, but it does. And so here we are. I'm going to work on it, but you need to know this. Or you may need to say, I'm going back to my mother's and I'll see you in 4 months. You know, it's just like, I can't do this anymore. That may be what you have to say, because you're not going to get anywhere just pretending to be a saintly person you're not, because sooner or later it's going to smash into you. So part of it also is to just be very interested in my, you know, when I lost my temper about him not answering the phone, it was extremely interesting to me. I haven't lost my temper very much in a long time. Wow, look how upset I can get about that. You know, and after I realized it really wasn't about whether he answered the phone, it was, isn't that interesting? You know, just look at the vritti that I have in me that can just be brought to the surface by a ringing telephone. And so I'm solving the problem by being extremely interested in my own limitations. You know, not proud of them, as I often say, but not ashamed of it either. I'm not proud of it, but I'm not going to be ashamed of it. This is just where I stand. And this is just how I am. So now I have to have a strategy for working with what I really can do. You know, I'm not a particularly good singer, but I can sing well enough to sing in our choir, but I always have to stand next to someone who's singing the right notes right in my ear. Because if not, I'm absolutely lost. So I can do it, but I know my limitations, so I have a strategy for working with it. So we know what our potential is, we know our limitations, then we develop a strategy for working with it. And in parenting and relationships, you have to have a strategy. For many years, David would just always want to do one more thing before we would leave to go somewhere, or he would go in to do some work and it would just take longer than he thought. And I spent so much time just being impatient. I finally just started bringing something to read. It was just as simple as that. If I had a book in my hand and could just sit somewhere and read the book, then it was fine. He could do whatever he wanted to do. And it was just a strategy for coping. I didn't have the generosity of heart or the patience of nature to just let him do what he wanted to do, so I had a strategy. My strategy was this. Or something is happening that I don't approve of, I just walk out of the house. If I don't see it, I'm not experiencing it. Just that's as simple as it is. I'm not Christ-like in my forgiveness, but my strategy is set up. Or if I'm about to say something I really don't want to say, I walk out of the house. was a period of time when I had to walk out of the house a lot because I was trying to change things in my own nature that I just couldn't change. So I just had to remove myself from temptation. That's your strategy for coping, because you're trying to solve it in the right direction. And that right direction is transformation rather than making the world behave according to your wishes.
So the way you're putting it right now is every individual has, so if he has a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
He thinks about the problem, he thinks about the solution mm-hmm. from his perspective.
Right.
And if there's another person involved, then you want that person to follow that solution instead of discussing the problem first with him, trying to understand his perspective, trying to understand what his solution might be, and then putting forward your solution and
exactly.
An amicable decision on that.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to think is, where did this whole thing start in the person's mind? How did that person start coming up with the reasoning of, for this problem, this is the solution? And maybe it just boils down to the childhood state where he was taught to do certain, to solve certain problems in a certain
uh-huh.
way, and he was not, or he or she was not taught
exactly.
to think of different solutions might
yeah.
be present for the same problem. To have an understanding that different individuals may think that different solutions are correct in different ways,
right.
And trying to put that understanding from in that person since childhood, so that when he grows up, he has the ability to understand
right.
solutions, different solutions for the same problem, and trying to find peace with any solution that might be presented to him.
Well, see, this is where we go back to the vrittis in the chakras.
Right.
And the vrittis in the chakras are formed over many, 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 many incarnations of experience.
Right.
And so, yes, you're right. I mean, upbringing has some influence, but only a certain amount, because you also relate to your upbringing according to your inclination. That also, children from the same household can have very different experiences. A friend of mine is one of two sisters, and she thinks her parents were fabulous, and the other sister thinks her parents were terrible. They just grew up in the same house, but just saw it even from the beginning completely differently. The result was completely different. And so where does that begin? That begins, I suppose, when the soul is created and starts on its long journey of experience.
So you would say nature versus nurture would be more of...
I say karma is everything, even DNA. You see, nurture is the result of the karma that brought you to be nurtured in that particular way. And sometimes karma is very complicated. So you can't always reason your way out of it. But just knowing how individual perception is it's just stunning sometimes. I love what you say. You want to sit down and talk together about the problem and come to an amicable solution. Of course, one party may never want to talk about the problem because they were raised in such a way never to talk about the problem. I mean, you know, there's just nothing can be assumed. You have to find out what vibration you're really dealing with and then make a strategy according to what you're actually dealing with, not to what you wish was there. Is that a response to what you say?
It is more of a thought that I'm
yeah.
looking forward rather than a question.
But it's a very, very true and very good thought. Where does it begin? And now you're going to raise a child and try to figure out.
That's why I'm like, if yeah. you want to raise a child, wouldn't you want the child to understand, like, different problems come to him and is there a different solution? And you should try to teach the kid from when she's small enough, you or she's small enough, that, okay, these are the different solutions for this problem, and what is it that you would do
right.
in this situation?
I think if I were parenting, and, you know, I would try to really, as clearly as possible, understand what the most important issues are so that you don't get bogged down in details. You know, it's like, what is the most important issue? And one you're describing is to be solution-oriented and to be creative in your solutions. You know, not to be narrow in your sense of the possible. I mean, if you have that clearly in your mind as a value, you can consistently reinforce it.
So, I mean, the point is not the solution, but it's just trying to imbibe the different vibrations
yes.
related to a particular problem.
Exactly.
That person, so that if that person comes across a different individual with a different vibration, he or she can understand that vibration and see that perspective on a particular problem.
Exactly. You know, there's a very sweet story that one of my friends told me about his son. His son was at school, and a boy who was having a very difficult home life bullied him. I mean, you know, did something that was unkind and hurt him. And my friend's son came home, and he was very upset about it. You know, I'm just really mad at that kid, and I'm going to get him tomorrow, and all these different things. And the father was wise enough to not interfere when he was that upset. But later, you know, at bedtime, when the child was calmer, the father brought up the subject again. And, you know, the first thing he said was, you know, that boy is, the little boy, the son, knew why the other boy was having such a hard time. I don't know if it was a divorce or what it was. You know, so he was unhappy, and he was taking out his happiness on you. And all he really wants to be is your friend. You know, you could just be his friend. And then the little child answered his father, "Daddy, I don't want to be that good." It was just a perfectly honest answer. Yes, I could be noble and that expansive, but I don't want to be. Okay, that's not going to work. You know, what are we going to work on now? But, you know, there would be an inclination to say you should be. But there's another way to work with it. Okay, that's really, you know, that's his response. That's an honest response to that. So how are we going to work from there? And, you know, the creativity to just actually hear what's being said and work with it to move it in the direction you want instead of trying to suppress it. I remember when I was 10 years old, I remember this so vividly, I really think it's the truth. I took up with bad friends for a couple of years because the most interesting children in the school to me at that time were a pretty rowdy crowd. And my parents were a little alarmed because I'd basically been a pretty good kid. But I remember saying to my parents, this is what I declared to them, "The die is cast," is what I said to my parents. "I'm either a good kid or a bad kid, and there's nothing you can do about it now." I mean, in retrospect, my parents must have died laughing as soon as they walked out of the room. But the odd thing is that I knew it was true. I really knew it was true. I knew that I was small enough to have to live with them, and they had control over me, but that I was in charge of my own consciousness. I was, you know, and I really was. And that really their opinions were extremely peripheral to my actual life. Now, my life has borne that out, in truth. But still, I look at children sometimes and I think, you know, they're much less malleable than we think they are. At the same time, and my parents did have a responsibility and they were bad companions. And the fact that my parents didn't like them eventually did persuade me to go elsewhere for friends. But still, it's very interesting to think about that. So yeah, it's very challenging, fascinatingly fun. Do we want to let's take a short break and then we'll just come back with any remaining questions before we call it a day, okay? People imagine that free will is, it's even possible to imagine free will that is completely cut out from interrelationship. You know, our little individual spark of consciousness is absolutely integrally involved with absolutely everything else in creation. To even think for a second that you could draw a tight circle around what you think of as yourself and that entity could move without being integrally connected and influenced by everything else in the universe, It's scientifically false. And yet we're enamored of this idea that we have that potential. But there's absolutely no basis for it in either spiritual or physical science. Because where do you draw the line? Where do you cut it? This woman whose grandchild sneezed in her face and she got a cold. And she just started thinking about all the different things that had to happen for her to even have a grandchild. You know, starting back to when? When do you cut it off? When you know, the great-great-grandparents, you know, found each other and had that baby, and then, you know, at what point do I have the free will to be not holding or not holding this grandchild? Now, at the same time, when we start thinking like that, we get into this sense of, you know, we imagine that the next result is, well, why make any effort anyway? Why not just, you know, why not just drift downstream? First of all, we're not constituted to drift downstream. As one of my friends once put it, it's not that easy to lie down and die. We get bored, we get hungry, we begin to itch. You know, we get up. So even to become passive with the thought that it doesn't, it's all predestined, it's not going to happen, because part of how we're programmed, and the programming is actually not in the conditions of our life. The programming is at our origin point. And our origin point is the river seeking the sea. Someone asked once, at what point does the soul begin to seek to reunite with God? Well, at what point does the river begin to seek the ocean? If there is a river, the river is going to seek the ocean. If there is an individual, that individual is going to seek to merge with everything. Now, merging with everything, merging back to our divine source, is not really about accomplishing this, accomplishing that, doing this, doing that. That's not really what it is. It's mastering the impulses within us that block our perception of the unity that already exists. And the way the individual seeks the sea is we are compelled to struggle against our own confining downward seeking tendencies in order to experience our unlimited potential. And whether we seek that by becoming wealthy, by becoming an athlete, by building a family, whatever it looks like, what we're actually doing is we're trying to overcome the downward pulling tendencies and experience our unconfined, unlimited potential. And the only actual choice we have in the matter is which way our energy goes. But even that, there's no point at which you can cut it out. So it really becomes a matter of how I'm made. You know, we don't have free will about how we're made because we didn't make ourselves. And sometimes people try to create too much self-mastery on the wrong level. The self-mastery is that I can make my life anything I want it to be in the form of it without taking into account all the past karma that you may have had. The free will that you have is you can apply yourself with absolute intensity to overcoming limitation and experiencing freedom. And how that manifests, though, is to a large extent already woven into the fabric of it. You're going 100 miles an hour, and when it occurs to you that you want to slow down the car, it doesn't slow down like that. There's just tremendous momentum. And, you know, we're like a tapestry, is the way I like to think of it. You know, if you look at a picture tapestry, there's a picture over here. But, you know, you can make a frame around that, but all the threads that are in that go all the way back to here and would never have arrived at this point without that journey. So how can you call free will right here? You know, you just can't snip those threads because those threads are integral to what you are right now. Does that make any sense? It's a very, very hard question. So yes, to a very large extent, your fate is predetermined. But your experience of that fate is where your free will comes in. Whether or not you experience that fate as a joyous adventure or as an excuse to be miserable, that's really where the choice comes in. And then, in an interesting way, that also begins to affect the external world. It's that question comes up so much. I don't know if that really even makes sense, but I try to understand it myself. There's another question too, which is, instead of asking, do I have free will, you ask, what actions, thoughts, and attitudes increase my happiness and decrease my suffering? Because really, that's a much more important question than free will. Is, am I miserable and can I do anything about it? Am I fulfilled and can I do anything about it? Because that's the fulcrum point of your actual life experience. Everything else, as I was saying at the beginning, is based on that. however you formed that. Does that make sense? And that's where open-hearted loving, since that's the subject of our conversation, generally makes you happier. Even though it also makes us miserable. It makes us miserable, and then we try to live without it, and we just go back. And
it's just very amazing. You know, throughout my life, I think about it, and ultimately, despite, you know, the moments of real pain, but ultimately, my life is really amazingly blessed.
Uh-huh.
That makes me wonder, is that...
Yeah, isn't that... Yeah.
You know, I look at certain other, you know, situations or people that I can see they are really going through some major suffering, and I'm thinking, I have never been through that.
Yeah.
And so many of my friends and family have never been through that. And I'm thinking, how did I end up on this other thread?
Well, it's all waves on the ocean. That's not to say you haven't been there or won't ever be there. It's just to say that the wave you're riding now is not going there. And you should be very grateful for that. And what the best way to increase and ensure good karma is with right attitude. The more gratitude, the more joy, the more self-giving, the more likely all of those vibrations are likely to continue. Once a woman exasperated me so much that I said something that I deeply regretted, but there was truth in it anyway, even though I shouldn't have said it. She was just complaining about everything, and I said, God forgive me, I said, if you're not careful, God's going to send you a real problem. You know, meaning just with that constant carping attitude, you'll just take what you do have, and it'll just wipe it out of your life. So the way to ensure it is not mysterious. You know, gratitude, selfless giving. I mean, you know, I've watched so many people ruin their lives. And they tend not to ruin their lives in one gigantic, dramatic gesture. They ruin their lives by letting themselves fall into a constant attitude of carping dissatisfaction until their whole vibration becomes that. I mean, you see it in old people around you. You know, it's not the age of your body that makes you old. It's that constant carping dissatisfaction that makes you old. And you watch people whose lives are really just fine make certain that they're always unhappy for some reason. And it's a very serious flaw. And a lot of times people get into that thinking they're being conscientious, you know. But what they're really doing is they're just making sure. I was talking to a woman friend of mine who's just determined to be unhappy. And I said, you know, it's like you're... My response was, I said, it's so egoic because everyone around you can see all the reasons why you should be happy and you're just determined to hold a contrary point of view no matter what. And why? You know, what is it doing for you? It's very important to be happy. You want to take care of your babies? Be happy. You know, 100 million times more important than anything else you read in a book is just be happy. Just be happy. It's so much fun to be with people who are happy, isn't it? And you just can't wait to get away from people who are not. And circumstances will not always make you happy. Sometimes circumstances are terrible. But like attracts like. And in the Bible, there's that horrible statement, even to those who have, more shall be given. And to those who have not, even the little they have shall be taken away. I mean, it's enough to make you close the whole book and want to put it in the incinerator. It's terrible. But he's really talking about magnetism. To those who have a consciousness of lack, they will not only not get more, they will even lose what they have because they will constantly be affirming lack. And you have to be very careful because you can also affirm it about yourself. Oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not doing this well enough. I should be doing this better. If you constantly affirm lack, even the little you have, the little self-confidence, self-worth will be taken away from you. But for those who have and who always are just conscious of the fact, you know, I sometimes think of myself as a disciple and say, you know, Master, I may be the worst disciple you have. You know, on the whole list of all your disciples, I may be the last name on the list, but I am on the list. You know, it's just like, maybe you can't claim to be the best, But just take whatever little piece of it you can hold on to and insist upon it. You know, maybe my house is messy and maybe I could do more for my kids, but I love them the best I can. You know, I'm a good mother. And just be happy. Everything comes from bliss. Everything comes from bliss. And then, I don't know, free will takes care of itself. That's it. Wow. Do we have any other thoughts or questions? If not, I'm running out of thoughts myself. Anything else?
Well, I was just thinking throughout our discussion how better it would be if more people in the world would understand this. Like this situation in Syria, for example, right?
Yeah.
It's just one guy holding on to his power and getting rid of so many thousands of people. So,
it's really just stunning. The things that if you really think about it and try to make the world fair or even sensible, it just breaks your heart. Yeah. You have to trust God when it's very hard to trust God. If you think of it in terms of reincarnation, even in terms of Bhagavad Gita, you know, Arjuna says, I don't want to kill my cousins. Krishna says, well, you see their bodies die, I see their souls ascend. You think of it as death, I think of it as transition.
No. But it looks like, I mean, even for looking at from this perspective, fine, it might have been their destiny if this would happen, but in a sense, they're stopped short. So whenever a person dies, it's only that they're being stopped short of their effort to be a little better, because they'll have to again start in the material world and learn everything again. So.
Well, you start where you stopped. You don't lose ground. That's another. I mean, Krishna, Arjuna asked Krishna that. What if I make the supreme effort to realize God and I give up everything else and it fizzles and I don't get there? That was when Krishna said, my devotee is never lost. But what he also said was, you know, the good karma that you gain from your sincere effort will be your starting point in your next incarnation. Because it's metaphysics. Your chakras have the pattern of exactly where you are at the point at which you leave your physical body, and there's no way you can start from any other point. You have the tiresomeness of hanging out in the womb and, you know, having to wear diapers and be fed and all that, which, you know, you don't have much control over your life. But your latent potential is exactly where it was when you stopped.
But then it would take you some time to realize, even if the metaphysical sense was the same.
Right.
At the connection of the physical body to the metaphysical self is it maybe in the next life, if you're not trained to look out for it, then you will never find it.
Well, but Krishna also answers Arjuna and says, basically, you will be brought to a family that will teach you at a young age. In fact, he says, even though birth to yogis is very hard to come by, if your karma is very good, you'll be born into a family of yogis. But he answers that exactly because of a very serious question. You will be given the opportunities that are exactly appropriate for you, including born to wealth so that you can work out your desires when you're younger, or born into wisdom, into a wise family, so that you can be trained from the beginning. And then you'll be guided to find the path young, because even though you're still a baby, you're still exactly who you were. And whatever you were longing for when you died will be the dominant force in your life. But yes, this is not a high planet right now. This is a planet in which really awful things are happening. And there's just, you know, for some reason we thought it was a good idea to live here. But there's a lot of really, really bad things going on. And there's just nothing you can do about it. Because it's beyond our control. We can only influence magnetically where we are. But we have a huge influence where we are.
But I often wonder, I mean, if there are these yogis with such a magnetism, would they choose to not intervene in such things? Or would they maybe, in Asad's dreams, maybe they come and they tell him to...
it's an interesting question because, you see, it's not a different question than raising your own baby. It's like a person can only learn what they're able to learn. And if you try to teach them something that's way far beyond their capacity to learn, they can't learn it. But can they learn nothing? No, everybody can always learn something. There's always a way to go forward and expand your understanding. But what does that step look like? You know, just to confuse it, because the world perspective The perspective of the ego is not necessarily the full perspective. Like, maybe some of those young men, or it's probably mostly men who are being massacred in Syria, I don't watch the news anymore because it's too depressing. But let's say, maybe the whole point of their incarnation was to have the courage to risk their life to stand up for this. And maybe being killed is the absolute victorious fulfillment of their life. Because everything was focused toward the... Maybe they allowed injustice to happen around them and didn't have the courage. Maybe they protected themselves at the expense of others. And now it's a very important karma for them to go forward and do that. You know, this evil man who's doing all of that, you know, he's had the gift of the opportunity to be helpful, and now he's used it instead to be murderous and terrible. And he's determined on that path. You know, there, he could be surrounded by angels, but he's not listening. So it isn't really the wisdom of those who could help him. It's the receptivity of wanting to be helped. And one certainly wants to take it as a personal lesson that you always want to have your heart and mind and spirit open. And then people just have to work out their karma. And to us it looks horrible, but it all works out in the end. That's the only thing you can say is that the masters say it does. This is the yuga that we're living in. This is the transition from Kali into Dwapara. It's very elevated and very depraved simultaneously. And the two forces are striking against each other. The man who has the power in Syria is the old consciousness of egoic control and repression. The young people whose lives are being taken are the new consciousness of freedom and self-expression. And they're just, at this moment in time, just smashing into each other. Ultimately, he will lose because we are in an upward moving cycle. But if this was a downward moving yuga, then ultimately he would win. And we would ask ourselves even more, why did we choose to incarnate here? I don't know. But here we are. Yeah, it's very tough. But you see, if you believe in God, if you believe in the principles of karma, if you trust that God is in charge of this world, you have to be able to take that all the way through. It's like that same thing. You can't just believe in God when it pleases your ego and then over here somebody else is in charge. But is that challenging? Oh my, yes. And I think that's one of the reasons we're here. Yeah, I actually literally at a certain point I thought, I can't really do anything about what's going on around the world. It just makes me really sad. So I just stopped trying to find out. I mean, you still hear it. You can't help but know. But I no longer try to know. Because I feel that in trying to share with people an uplifted way to relate to the world, I'm doing everything I can to fix it. And far from being dropped out, I feel like I am deeply engaged in solving the problem in Syria. But this is the only way I can think of to solve it. The first time I went to India, and the concept overpopulation, which had only just been a concept to me, actually became real. There are just way too many people here. And just the whole magnitude of, you know, what has to be sorted out for India to rise to its appropriate level and take its place in the world. The only solution is consciousness. The only solution with the whole planet is consciousness. Every problem could be solved. We have all the resources, all the technology. We do not want to solve the problems because people want their egoic satisfactions, however they define them, more than they want to solve the problems. In other words, it's all about consciousness. So I am intensely politically active without reading the news. You know? Any other thoughts or questions before we close up? Okay, great souls, thank you for spending some of the morning with me. It's been the morning with me.